CliffCentral.com.
All right, it is a Thursday morning, which means it's time for the Burning Platform, brought to you by Nando's. This morning we are joined by Rob Hutchinson and Pumi Mashiho, who are our star contribution this morning to discussing all the things that are going on in the world and in South Africa that we need to know about. It's really like a little diet pill that you can take on a Thursday morning to just fill you in. So if you get into a conversation or an argument, for that matter, with anyone during the course of the day today and the course of this weekend, you'll be able to say, ah, but X, Y, and Z that I heard on the Burning Platform. And today will be no different, of course. So let me just quickly introduce...
Don't get into arguments.
Well, we do. We like an argument every now and then, Pums. I mean, you know, you have some on this show and you're very good at it. So Rob Hutchinson is the MD of Dear South Africa, an established civil organization which facilitates public participation in government policy formation. And Rob, I mentioned that you were one of the groups right at the beginning of lockdown last year who said, we're not going to tolerate this nonsense from government. Took them to court and got them to do the right thing eventually. I'm always disappointed that we have to keep taking our government to court to do these things. But then they, of course, complained, oh, well, who are these civil organizations? Do you still get noise from people saying, who the hell are you to be telling the government what to do?
Yeah, absolutely. It's par for the course in this game, really. It's people have different views, and not most of them based on ideology as it is. So they don't read the facts and check the consequences of certain government actions. When people start trusting the government to, you know, unbelievable levels, you've got to sort of step back and say, why? Are you crazy? You can't just trust your government and let them go out there. Although we should be trusting government, but there's always those people who, you know, although it might be a handful of people, they tend to be the loudest and shout back at us and say, just let it happen. Government must be right. They've done their research. And then we just come back with the facts and say, well, they haven't. Yeah, here are the facts, and believe what you want to believe, but we're going ahead.
Yeah, I suppose there's a healthy balance to be maintained between trusting your government to do the right thing and also checking on them when they're not doing the right thing. And I'm afraid if in the last 10 years or so our government had covered themselves in glory and given us every reason to trust them, we might be more trusting.
Absolutely.
But I'm very pleased that there are organizations like yours that are taking them on various important matters.
Well, thanks,
all right, so let's talk quickly about the elephant in the room, which is the elephant that is the ANC. Some people would say it's a white elephant, even though that would, for racial essentialists, be exactly the opposite of what the ANC is. A white elephant in terms of the fact that it has perhaps outlived its usefulness, the liberation movement that brought South Africa, or a large part of what brought South Africa into freedom and democracy, is starting to look decayed. It's starting to look irrelevant. It's starting to look like it's really just a network of patronage, and in this case, a very factionalized network of patronage. Yesterday, we saw probably one of the most seismic changes in local politics that we have seen in many years. And it's something which people like Pumi, to her credit, has predicted for a couple of years now, and many other people have predicted too, that the ANC is eventually going to split down the middle. And we are now facing a split, at least in terms of the jibes that are being traded between Cyril Ramaphosa and Ace Magashule, the Secretary General and the President of the ANC. It's yet to be seen what all of this will result in and whether it will result in an immediate split or whether people will try to patch this up again with some more masking tape and Band-Aids and staples and whatever else they can find. But the fact is that the ANC is starting to tear itself apart in front of our very eyes. Let's talk about what you think of that, Rob, and then I'll let Pumi come in because she actually filled me in this morning on Pule Mabe's comments to Ace Magashule. But maybe you have some comments on what you think is going on in the ANC and what you think the result of this will be for South Africa.
Yeah, well, I think we're headed for disaster, to be honest, because the ANC, no matter which faction it is or which side it is, they're not going to let go of power of the country. And that doesn't spell good news for South Africans in general. We mustn't forget that Cyril Ramaphosa did say that ANC comes first before anything else, and which was the start of the trouble. But You know, I think the split in the factionism has been going on for ages. It can go all the way back to when COPE was formed. That was a major split there. And this is just a repeat of that. So we might see another party emerge, but I think the ANC will stay as it is, filled with new, dare I say, struggle heroes in the positions that become vacant as such. Whether the new party that does form, if it does, will suffer the same fate as COPE, I probably have no doubt that it will. You know, COPE was infiltrated right in the very beginning and set up to fail. It had great success, but that was just ANC hang-ons, and it didn't have the leadership or the will or the know-how to actually.
Really, COPE probably fell apart more because of the arguments between Mosiwa Lekota and Mbazi Mashiloa than anything else. Because they couldn't even decide who the leader was. Remember, they eventually had to go to court to decide who was actually in charge of COPE. And by that stage, anyone, including me, who had voted for COPE, was just completely, we were disillusioned.
Totally. I suspect that's exactly what's going to happen in this new split, if the split does happen. Although Ace Magashule is quite belligerent in his ways and goes forward, and he can get his way, there are other players that will also want to be in the lead there. So it's going to be another factional fight and then split up into other little factions and so on. But I don't think that we'll see the ANC disappear. I really don't. It's they'll stay around and they'll still be in power in one form or another. So what it means for the country is a big question hanging in the air.
So really, Pumi, I'm going to ask you not only as an analyst, but sorry, Pums, I also want to ask you as someone who knows how marketing and branding works, because the ANC is a brand and they're not going to throw that away. Yeah. But carry on with your comments and I'll come back to that. You think it's gone already?
They've already completely squandered the brand that they inherited. But, you know, I think that there's another part. I don't think we can say that we don't know what that means for South Africa. We know exactly what that means for South Africa. It means there's nobody at the helm. If all of the people that are supposed to be running the country and worrying about the things that really are for South Africa, worrying things like the fact that we've got such high unemployment, like the fact that we have got a stagnant economy, like the fact that we have 30 million South Africans living on less than 20 rand a day. All of those people are currently so consumed by what is happening inside the ANC, which for all intents and purposes is not even 1% of South Africa. Yeah. That means not only is there somebody sleeping at the wheel, there is nobody at the wheel. This bus is careening down the road without a single person holding that steering wheel or even checking for potholes. That's the problem.
But it's not a new thing. I mean, there hasn't been someone at the wheel for quite some time. Really, there hasn't.
had the illusion that somebody, you know, we had the illusion that there was a president worrying about these things, that there were ministers, we had that illusion. But now, we don't even have that illusion anymore. We are quite clear of the fact that all of the people that should be worrying about all of us as South Africans are not, because they're all worried about whether they're being suspended
But isn't our deputy president the perfect person to be our caretaker at this time? I mean, Didi Mabuza, we trust him, right? And he's been very vocal. He's been so helpful, hasn't he, Rob? I mean, am I being sarcastic or am I not? You tell me.
No, you're being hell of a sarcastic. Mabuza is pretty much doing what Cyril Ramaphosa did during the Zuma presidency, just sitting back and watching. But
biding his time.
Actually do it, absolutely, he's just biding his time. Mm-hmm. Once you get into politics, especially at that level, you've got to understand that they're just puppets out there. They're not doing any governance as such. And there's a definite difference between politics and governance. The problem with the ANC is they still call themselves a liberation movement. Exactly. I mean, Ramaphosa said that in his testimony to Zondo Commission was ANC is a liberation movement and we stole that. And, you know, that kind of thinking exactly tells you where their headspace is. They're not used to governance. They've been winging it literally for the past 27 years. And they all they do is they play internal politics and see who can get to the top and what factions they can cause and start an internal struggle because that's what they know how to deal with. And then leverage off that internal struggle and call that the new liberation movement. So all Ace has been doing is he's been creating and leading the internal struggle, which is the new liberation lead to the new ANC that Gareth talked about, marketing and whatever. This is a perfect marketing opportunity for the ANC to say, we've recognized the problems. Here's our platform. We're starting at the bottom and we are going to build back better, to use a horrible term.
Yeah, to use overused term.
That's what they're going to do.
Isn't that what Cyril...
We've seen this before.
Isn't that what Cyril tried to do, Rob?
Good tactic of playing good cop against bad cop. And it's, but they're both the same person at the end of the day because it's about the party, not about the individuals. And the decisions are made by a collective, not by an individual.
Yeah, but
so,
but Rob, isn't that what Cyril tried to do at the State Capture Commission? He said, look, all of this stuff has happened and, you know, we're very sorry about it. And
Of course,
I had nothing to do with any of those appointments. And, you know, it wasn't me. And I was just sitting there and it was this CADA deployment, still a good idea. And the ANC still knows what to do, but we just forgive us for all our trespasses in the past couple of years. And we will be better. That's what he tried to do. It was an exercise in spin. Do you think any of that worked? I mean, here you are saying essentially they have a chance to rebrand. I don't think Pumi believes that. I'm just judging by her facial expressions. Pumi, you say it's already squandered and wasted.
Yeah, I mean, if we think about the life of brands, brands can only stretch themselves so far. And brands have to, you know, for people to continue believing in the brand, it needs to deliver on a particular thing. And it does happen that brands outlive their usefulness. I mean, if you think about a brand that has world over for a very, very long time, if you think about Coca-Cola and the way that they are constantly evolving to stay relevant to the market. You know, Coca-Cola is a young brand. Even if your 80-year-old grandmother still drinks a glass of Coke every single day, but it remains in the way that it portrays itself as a refreshing brand, as a accompaniment to every meal. And the ANC has failed to do that. So what the Rob, you talk about the fact that they still call themselves a liberation movement. We're beyond that. We're beyond that now. And they keep holding on to that identity and that brand essence, as it were. And it is because of that that they are unable to remain relevant. You know, so for the people that it matters to, it still matters to them. The people that are loyal ANC, and we've spoken about this on the show before, that we have that in South Africa where we have people in the States they call it yellow dog politics, right? People who will rather vote for a yellow dog than any other party. We have got that here. And those people who are loyal to the ANC will remain loyal to the ANC and all of the other parties. Even if there's a split, I mean, one of the things that COPE struggled with, besides their leadership battles, what they really struggled with at COPE is the fact that you cannot be a coalition of the disgruntled.
Which of the factions here is the disgruntled?
Your mic is off, Gareth.
Sorry. That's so embarrassing. So which of these factions is the disgruntled coalition? I mean, you could argue that both are, but it sounds to me like Ace he's working hard to kind of project, as Rob says, the struggle side. This is the new struggle. This is the new cool kids club. Whereas the old ANC is kind of the dinosaur, you know, with Cyril and Lindiwe Sisulu and all of those sort of people in it. So who do you think will win that battle in terms of pulling the ANC's branding with them? Who do you think will pull those yellow dog voters with them? And what will happen to the other one? I mean, let's play a little bit of Nostradamus here. And let's see in a year or two who got it right. Rob, what do you think?
Yeah, well, I think Cyril will start the new evolved fourth industrial revolution at ANC, because he's very much led by European forces, and he follows a very strong UN or United Nations and African Union influence, whereas ACE doesn't have that. ACE is more localized, and therefore he'll keep the traditional ANC going. How it will play out, I think we might be in for a surprise as to see ACE might not actually leave the ANC, but maybe might be deployed somewhere else or shifted around. It's too dangerous for the ANC to totally get rid of him. They might have suspended him now, but I saw the most ridiculous thing this morning on Twitter, where he's now issued a suspension to Ramaphosa. That just shows you that there's a definite power struggle between the two. And all they're looking for now is support from below the ranks, and or from the lower ranks. So I don't know if it's really going to cause a split. There might be a bit of a disciplinary hearing, or between the both of them, they might talk it out and settle it out. But you know, we can't put aside the fact that this might just be a whole marketing thing. And I don't want to sound like a cynic here, but it might just be a marketing thing to get everyone attention to the ANC. Yes, we're going to do all this, right, and then they recover.
You've put a lot of caveats into your prediction, but I'll take it. How about yours, Pums? Do you want to throw in anything different? You want to throw in anything different there, in case we come back to you in a year's time, like Rob, and we say no, you were completely wrong. Your credibility is smashed.
I don't think that there's going to be a split.
Really?
I don't think that there's going to be a split. And I think that the party is very unlikely to expel ACE. They've learned a hard lesson with Julius and what happened when they did that. So I think they're going to be reluctant to expel him. But I do think that there's going to be some kind of what they failed to do with Jacob Zuma, a political solution to their problems.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to come to some kind of political solution. Also, the guys are unlikely to walk away. I just look at what happened with Ramaphosa last week, right? Is when you do get suspended, these guys' entire identity is linked to this organization.
Well, Supra Mahuma Pen,
and their livelihoods.
Yeah.
Oh, Supra, I mean.
Yeah.
So their identities and their livelihoods are so intricately linked to this organization that walking away is not an option for them.
You know, it's such a damning thing to know that most of these people are unemployable in any part of the economy other than politics. The only way they could have ever made themselves useful is to become parts of a political party and parts that can be adjusted for size and for use wherever needed. In other words, these are not
for purpose.
Yeah, fit for purpose. These are not people who. Yeah, these are not people who would find any practical application in any other field. It's absolutely unbelievable.
Yeah.
And I'm in serious doubt as to whether or not their political usefulness is particularly high either. All right, let's move along, because I don't want to get stuck in this like we often do in ANC party politics. Can we talk about SARS for a second? Because SARS Commissioner Edward Kieswetter on Wednesday said that the Revenue Service would act without fear or favor against any individual or entity that did not meet their tax obligations. You know, I met with my auditor this week and we looked at my tax situation, and, you know, I'm probably in the position that many South Africans are in, where you're paying into SARS, you don't get anything back. You feel very often that tax is it's a license fee. It's like the TV license. You don't even watch SABC TV or listen to SABC radio, but you've still got to pay for it because other people do. And there's a part of all of us, even if it's a smaller part in some people and a big part in others, where we realize, like, part of our duty and responsibility to the country we live in is that we've got to help finance things. And I'm not bitter and twisted about that. I don't like the idea of exorbitant taxes, and I think we're getting close to that. Many people in this country are starting to feel that the tax burden is too high, especially when you include ESCOM, municipal and local taxes. You include, you know, the cost of basic education, the cost of healthcare, the cost of all of these things, which are a tax on their own, because the government can't provide those things at competitive prices. either way, Edward Kiesvet is saying this, and on his way out of my meeting, my auditor said to me, what do you think of what's going on in the ANC? And I said to him, what a strange question for you to ask me after we've been talking about finance the whole time. And he said to me, no, because, you know, there are these people who are not paying taxes. We heard about Malusi Gigaba the other day when his ex-wife Norma was at the State Capture Commission. And she was talking about these bags of money. Now, I don't know that Malusi Gigaba's taxes are up to date, but if there's cash money in bags being handed around, I can pretty much guarantee that's not something that Edward Kiesvet knew anything about. So when he says without fear or favor, does he actually mean we're going to go after the people who have been looting and pillaging and stealing and doing underhanded business? Or does he just mean he's going to get harder and he's going to start turning the screws on loyal, taxpaying, legal citizens? Which part of it does he mean?
Like that says, definitely look after the low-hanging fruit. They're desperate at this stage to raise more money, and introducing more and more taxes in various forms and adjusting tax scales as they go on. When he says he's going to get hard, it's no doubt on registered taxpayers. He's not going to concentrate too much on the corrupt, because that's going to cost money to recover, and rather than the cost benefit might not be there. So it's definitely clamping down on those who avoid tax. There was a talk about introducing a wealth tax on those who own a considerable amount of money, and increasing the tax rates and so on. But it's definitely clamping down. They've realized how much money escapes the country. So we're going to see more measures on excise tax and so on. Mm-hmm. And they talked about introducing the expat tax as well, because they realize a lot of people earn foreign currency while still staying in the country. So that's right. Another angle there. I think it's closing more of the loopholes. There's some estimates that South Africa loses around about 50 billion a year on people who avoid tax and so on. So that's, it's just a going after the low hanging fruit.
You know, it's like, I suppose. You know,
the question does come about there is that there's no point in increasing taxes when you've got already got an overtaxed, especially middle class, that's carrying most of the burden there.
In other words,
although it's estimated that about around 1,000 people, high income earners pay most of the tax, it's still funded and supported by mostly the middle class. So if you increase those taxes on people, they'll simply find more ways to avoid tax, which becomes a big problem.
So Rob, basically, if you are a person on the roads in South Africa and you have a licensed vehicle and you have a registered address, you get the fines. And the people who don't have a legal vehicle and it's not roadworthy and it doesn't have a license and it's not, you don't have a place of domicile written on the car ownership certificates, then those people just get away with not having to worry. So the bad people will continue to do what they do. Pums, do you agree with that? I mean, you've also got to look at this from a business point of view, because you're a businesswoman. You run your own business. Businesses are paying more than their fair share.
Look, the shrinking tax base. Gareth, I don't know if there's something happening with the sound. I keep getting feedback. But anyway, the shrinking tax base is what it is. But I think the thing we're not really talking about, which we've seen, that's what state capture has done for us, right, is show us exactly how much these institutions have been hollowed out. Because the reality is that SARS no longer has the capacity to go after the really big fish that are evading tax or avoiding it completely, you know. So we talk a lot about the illegal cigarette trade. You know, SARS no longer has the capacity for those investigations and to go after those guys. There's also nobody at SARS kind of going, Edward Sodi, I see you buying new cars and all. Let me see your tax returns and do those two things correspond? And going after those people. There's so much evidence in everyday life, you know, on Twitter, in the papers, and of people who are who have lots and lots of cash and are spending it, but they're probably not paying their taxes the way that they should. And nobody's doing that. But you know, you with your VAT return every 2 months, if you're like 2 hours late with your VAT return, you're getting a summons.
Right, exactly.
You, Gareth, with your late VAT return, look at, you know, your 5,000 Rand 10% interest 2 days later, and 3 days later, here's your summons. If you don't pay us, you're going to jail. That's actually what we should be more worried about. That's where we should be like concentrating our efforts, is to say, how do we rebuild this capacity inside SARS that they are able to do that? So the low hanging fruit is the low hanging fruit, but they've got to rebuild the capacity. That's what Edward Keys-Vetter should be talking about.
Right now they're looking for immediate solutions, and an investigation into a tax dodger is a long-term solution, and then the recovery only comes much, much later. So definitely it's going after those compliant taxpayers who are perhaps just, you know, pushing a bit to the side, trying to squeeze them for more and so on. Getting their books in order and their systems correct, and then maybe they will. Maybe once they've got that low-hanging fruit, then they'll be able to increase their capacity and go after the bigger guys. But I think, you know, all this talk about how much money has gone missing through corruption and so on, it's the money's got to have gone somewhere, because it's still, you know, the fiscus is only made up of so much money. So there's a huge amount that SARS hasn't been able to tax, and there's a huge amount that they are missing out on. So maybe it's something to do with all these commissions and so on. They're trying to find out who are revealing where the tax money has gone. It might be an Al Capone moment in South African history. who knows?
And the way these corrupt guys go down. You know, someone made a very good point on social media this week, and it made me laugh. Someone said, you know, in any other country, if you'd managed to swindle hundreds of millions out of the government, the first thing you do is you get out of that country, because, you know, you go somewhere where there's no extradition treaty. But these guys in the ANC who've been, you know, taking tens and hundreds of millions of rands out, they stay in the country because there's actually nowhere else they can go. So we can probably find them if we just put a little bit of effort into it. But at the same time, like, part of me says, this is the rebellious part of me, is like, why are we even supporting the work of SARS? Like, shouldn't we hope for SARS to completely collapse and fall apart? There's an anarchist in all of us that goes, most of the parts of this country, that the smaller municipalities, those places outside of the big centers, are already in anarchy. So why are we bothering to try and make what Helen Zille says the capable state? And we should rather just let it all fall apart. What the hell? Then we, you know, all of us should be dodging tax.
I must be honest. I struggle with those same thoughts every day. You know, when I see people start shouting,
oh, shame, Edward Keys-Vetter. Poor Edward Keys-Vetter and poor SARS. They don't have capacity. Good. You should fucking have no capacity.
I'm exactly like that. I look at people and say, they should be paying tax and the rich must pay tax. And I'm like, you idiots. No, we should all be learning a lesson from them. We should all be saying, none of us should pay tax, right? Why are you trying to force the side of the government here? The only way to stop corruption is to take away the food. That's it. So, yeah, if you bring the country to its knees. But
it already is on its knees. Yeah, I'm just sitting here going, why is nobody like phoning Anuj Singh? You know, we sat and listened for 2 nights in a row. And we're like, why is nobody like calling him up on some, listen, dude, just, you need to come over here and see us. That, you know, that 100,000 rand you were making every month.
Yeah, exactly.
On the side there, moonlighting. Where's that tax return? And just, you know what I'm saying? That doesn't need.
What's the easier way,
what's
Rob?
What's the easier one?
Look at Ace Magashula. I mean, he's in the spotlight right now. If Cyril really wanted to get rid of him, he'd just say, how is your net worth 74 million rand? Just explain.
Wow.
It doesn't. And that's the Al Capone moment. That's the Al Capone moment. They don't have to be like, how is your net worth? No. They just have to send him the bill for this is the SARS component of your net worth.
That's right.
Been a full-time career politician. then here's your salary. We got record of this. They don't accept it for million. Yeah.
I actually don't care about
you. Say, thank you.
Just give us our part. Just give me my cut of that 74 million without, you know, then you don't have to get into a where did it come from. There. Just give me my part. Just give me my slice
so,
of it.
So, I mean, this is
but an Malema. Malema also owes millions and has done nothing.
Yeah, I mean, nobody's going after him. You see, if this is what irritates most of us. And I think this is why it is, it's facetious in some ways for SARS to even make comments on these things when we know there are politically exposed individuals who are absolutely in SARS's debt, who need to settle those debts before they should be allowed to speak or even represent anyone in parliament. But you know, our laws are so lax in that respect. So let's just look at this story because it is quite a good story. Former health MEC for Gauteng, Dr. Bandile Masuku, will not be appealing a decision of the High Court which ruled against him in favor of the special investigating unit. So he's not even going to appeal this, which is that is a rare occurrence because usually these politicians will take things to the highest court in the land every time, even when it's got no constitutional jurisdiction. He announced he will not be pursuing charges because the findings were unequivocally exculpatory and had removed public doubt about him being corrupt. Well, that's interesting. I mean, that's one way to put it. But he's explained in a 4-page letter why he decided to no longer pursue the report which led to his axing. I mean, we can all tell why, because he's lost fairly and squarely.
Exactly.
And there's just nowhere else for him to go, right? So do we need to see more of these kinds of things? And how costly is it to get a Bandile Masuku not to appeal and to just quietly go into the wilderness? Because if it's cheap and we can afford to do it, we should do it more. But if it's too expensive, we've got to find another way. Yeah.
I think that's a good observation. It is place a cost value on it. And if you look at the Zondo Commission, which the cost of the Zondo Commission is already over R1 billion, and we've seen very, very little return from that, it perhaps apply the same logic here. In any good strategy, you allow your opponent an escape route. If you corner them, then they are bound to always fight back and defend themselves. And that's going to inevitably cost you all the taxpayer money because the money simply doesn't come from anywhere else. Mm-hmm. So if we provide each of these guys with a safe escape route and say, you know, the cost of recovery versus the cost of your escape, balance the two, see which way to go. Maybe that's what happened behind the scenes in that case is he was offered a golden handshake behind the scenes or whatever, just to go, and therefore drafted that letter, because that letter does seem very sort of out of character for anyone to admit that they were false. So there must have been something else in the background which was more enticing for him. And I think that would be a good strategy. Let them go. Just say, get the hell out. Yeah, take what you want. No questions asked. Just disappear.
Just go.
And I for one, as the member of the public, would say, great, let's go.
But then we must be vigilant as members of the public, because where is this wilderness that they go into? Uh-huh. They don't just like sit at home somewhere.
No.
They really just get recycled and pop
ANC,
up somewhere else.
ANC just redeploys them, right? That's all that happens.
So we have to be much more vigilant about it and also hold them to account. I think that the one thing that as South Africans we don't do nearly as much as we should do is pay attention to those little things and punish them at the polls for it.
Yeah.
We don't do that, which is what we should be doing. Because so he's not going to be the MEC for health in Gauteng, but, you know, he's going to pop up somewhere else as a DG or something. And, you know, and that's earlier, Gareth, you spoke about the pervasive nature of the ANC and how deep the roots of patronage lies. That's actually where the patronage is. They have been able to not only be in the political sphere, but also in the government sphere, where people who are supposed to have real jobs with real skill sets, which is what makes the rest of our country work outside of this organization, is so linked to the organization. That's the problem with their deployment committee. Yeah. That's the problem with their deployment policy, is that they're saying, actually, the DG over there, who's supposed to be a technocrat, no, that guy is going to be comrade so-and-so. And that's where That's where you need to punish.
So again, because I don't want us to get stuck in this, and we have spoken about all of it a little in the Burning Platform before, you know, the CADA deployment and so on. I want to hear, Rob, your thoughts about the vaccine passports, because, you know, this is something that ordinary people will probably have to deal with in the next couple of months. We see already, you know, that South Africans, I think we are one of the countries that it is the hardest to travel out of at the moment, even though we're largely coming out of the pandemic. Of course, vaccinations are not happening as quickly as we'd like. But people from South Africa can't just hop on a plane and go anywhere again like we used to. And I mean, that's visas and so on, notwithstanding, because we've become a little bit smelly to the rest of the world. You know, they don't look at us and welcome us with open arms anymore. We now have to have several stamps in our passports before we can go and visit most countries that people would want to visit. I mean, we can still go to shithole countries in Trump's language, but we can't really go to the ones that we might want to go to. So what is a vaccine passport going to mean for South Africans?
Yeah, I think it's not just going to be for South Africans. Obviously, it's going to be a global thing, but it's going to be a problem for South Africans in that the rollout of vaccines is just never going to reach the levels that we need it to. And I think we're going to be landlocked in South Africa for quite some time, with only a select few being able to travel as they need to. We're going to see airlines which have already said that you can't even book a flight if you don't have proof of vaccination. So leaving the vaccination up to the government, I think, was a horrific idea to start off with. There's no way the government could ever roll out a program like that. And then we were also involved in taking them to court to allow private companies and institutions to roll out the vaccine, along with AfriForum and a couple of others.
Yeah, and by the way, congratulations for doing that, because it's just an unbelievably stupid idea that government should be the only people who can provide this stuff. You also had to, weren't you also part of the action that forced them to relent, that doctors could be able to prescribe ivermectin?
We had an amicus in that case as well.
Again, thank God for you. What would we do without you guys?
That is exactly the kind of power that civil society has. That's the thing that we speak about all the time on the show, is there is power in organizing and being part of a collective. Get your friends involved. You get involved. That's the power that we have as civil society. We can hold them accountable. Well, we just have to find the ways and the means. And there's power in being a collective, in being a first, not a one person.
I just want to say quickly, before we carry on with your vaccine passports discussion, which I do want to get back to, there is also the point to be made that with our coronavirus infection numbers dropping as low as they have been in the last couple of weeks, and obviously they're all the fearmongers, and we should stop believing these people. We should just stop taking them seriously, the ones who are talking about a third wave when there's no evidence that that's going to happen. We are already reaching a kind of herd immunity with or without vaccines. We're getting there naturally, right? Maybe that's even more important than the vaccines. We can't rely on government.
It makes sense.
Yeah.
No, we can't rely on government. If you look at the statistics, nothing really makes sense, even from the word go. It's almost as if South Africa had a herd immunity before coronavirus even pitched up on our shores. Mm. And it might very well be the case, because the first new variant as such originated in South Africa, which suggests that the virus itself might have originated in South Africa. And I think in one way, I'm glad the government is so incapable of rolling out the vaccines, because we might not need it at the end of the day. However, it does bring into question the global vaccine passport and how it's going to affect us. We might perhaps see the whole revised strategy on the global vaccine passport, because infection rates across the world have gone down. That might have been seen as a necessity right in the beginning, but it certainly isn't necessary right now, especially given the stats behind the whole thing. And you have to look at the statistics in this type of pandemic, because nobody really knows the true science behind it. There's such supporting evidence for both sides of the argument that you can only really base any decisions based on facts and figures. I know Nick Hudson goes on a lot about that, but he's correct in that thing. It's a war on data more than a war on, of course,
we've got to be honest about the fact that many South Africans do not know how to interpret that information. So we're sold people's anecdotal stories about, oh, but my cousin died of COVID, so it's much worse than we think it is. That's not useful information. Yeah. That doesn't help anybody to fight these kinds of pandemics or these kinds of circumstances as governments or as organizations that are meant to tackle them. You have to deal with this stuff empirically. You can't deal with it emotionally.
Exactly. And there again, who do you trust in that source of data? Do you trust the government or do you trust a civil society organization? And I tend to steer definitely towards a civil society organization because of our experience with government as such. Mm. And Quinn's touched on a very interesting point there, is that civil society organizations or civil society as a whole really carries a hell of a lot more power than any political party or any government as such, because they work outside of the whole political system. And you can only influence the system from outside the system. You can't, once you enter that system, you lose all the power because you're actually controlled by the system. And justifies the necessity for a strong civil society organization. But it tends to get fragmented as it is. But I think in times of desperation like we see now, a lot of civil society organizations are grouping together on certain cases and recognizing their strengths and weaknesses and so
is
on.
It,
Whereas it, government operates as a whole, one thing, and this is how it is or not. Civil society has the blessing or the advantage of having different points of view to come up with the correct solution.
Is it not worth us mobilizing against a vaccine passport? You know, many states in the United States have said that they just won't recognize this vaccine passport nonsense. They said they think it's nonsense. Mm-hmm. And those states are standing up against the federal government on that front. It would be interesting if not all countries go for it, then the whole thing falls apart. Because if there's one hole in the bag, then the water comes out. So, it only requires a little bit of pushback for this to not become implementable.
Well, definitely, I think that's actually the angle, and perhaps South Africa would actually be the leader in collapsing the whole global vaccine passport system because of that exact fact. Our vaccine rollout is dismal, so there's no chance I don't even think 10% of the population will ever get vaccinated. So we simply can't have that. It'll be electronic sanctions against South Africa.
Yeah, but can I be an anarchic again, just as I was about SARS earlier? Because the anarchist part of me says, well, you know what? If I need to have this vaccine passport in order to travel, so what I'll do is I'll find a doctor who I can tame, and I'll say to the doctor, just give me a dose of the vaccine and I'll pour it down the sink and then we can carry on with our lives. And I'll have a stamp in my vaccine passport and we'll just carry on, because people will do that. And there will be people making fake vaccine passports, and you'll be able to buy them on the corner of Elof Street very, very soon. So why are we even bothering with this nonsense? Bureaucrats don't seem to understand that where they have a will, we have a different way.
Without a doubt, I think South Africa is the place to be if you want to go down that route, isn't it? But I totally believe. I mean,
Pumi's laughing.
I would do it.
Rob,
I'll go to the doctor.
I mean, we are so creative.
I'm laughing because Rob, do not allow Gareth to lead you down this path of anarchy. I see you being seduced by it.
Pumi is both thrilled and very frustrated today, because she's thrilled because we've got you on, Rob, and she's always talking about how civil society needs to take control of things and we need to stand up for ourselves and we need to make the change, right? Which is precisely what your organization does. So I know she's pleased about that. She's frustrated because she knows there are people like me. And maybe I'm
Gareth
not,
is corrupting you.
Maybe I'm not the one who actually does these things, but I promise you we're a country of very creative people when it comes to crime and not following the rules. We do not like following the rules, right, Pumi?
Hey, yes, us, your people.
It's not just me, though. It's everybody. This whole country is full of people who don't like following the rules.
Oh, Rob, I think you're
the
doing...
strongest entrepreneurial sector is in the criminal sector.
Guys, we've only got a little bit of time left, and I want to bring up something that's been bothering me for a while. Donald Trump has been banned from social media, right? And he just doesn't exist online anymore. And for some people, that's a huge relief, and they're thrilled because it means that they can put their head in the sand and pretend that he never existed anyway. And they're trying to expunge his entire existence, like he wasn't president, and I'll just pretend it never happened. You know, like those people who kind of, they have a relationship and it doesn't go the way that they think, so they just block and ghost and they pretend it never happened. It's a very childish way to live because he hasn't stopped existing and he's still there, and some of the things that he put into play are very much still in play. And regardless of how much you try to pretend, da 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 da, Donald Trump never was there. So it's like, you know, now Facebook, I didn't know this, but they have an oversight board, and Facebook's oversight board must be, you know, the most independent thing ever, because it's made up of people from inside of Facebook, the very people who banned him in the first place. They've decided that Donald Trump cannot return to Facebook and Instagram. I think this is very, very dangerous, not just on the grounds of free speech, where, you know, for heaven's sake, we've got every good argument is that the more speech we have, the better, even if it's offensive and unhappy and upsetting and all of those things. I would rather know what someone like Donald Trump is planning. I'd rather know, and he gave us such insights into the instability or the stability of his mind, depending on your point of view. But there's a lot going on there. We had stream of consciousness Donald Trump 24/7 during his presidency. And I think it's very dangerous to put people like him outside of the tent pissing in. It's better to have him inside the tent pissing out. As awful as some of the things that some people found about him were, now we don't know. And don't think that the people, the 73 odd million people in America who voted for him, have just gone away like he has on social media. Just because you've cleansed Twitter of him doesn't mean you've taken those people out. They're not dead. And don't think that they're sitting at home twiddling their thumbs going, we're just going to let this go and let Joe Biden and then Kamala Harris and then whoever else comes in after that carry on with whatever they like. There is going to be some shit to pay. And we have to give these people a place to speak, just like all the rest of us have a place to speak. What do you think of this, and how can we fix it? And do you have any comments on things like the Facebook Oversight Board?
Facebook Oversight Board. The images that come into my head now of green hair and red hair is quite horrific.
Oh, yeah.
That's probably what it is. Look, I think free speech is vitally important to any successful society. And the fact that Twitter banned him first, and now they're suffering a 13% drop in their share value speaks volumes. It doesn't. I can guarantee most of Trump's followers, whether on Facebook or Twitter, were people who hated him. So you know, it's they want to do this. They enjoy the entertainment, and let's face it, social media is entertainment. But it is dangerous to silence people like that and not give them a platform, because you're just turning up the heat on them and putting them in a corner, and they will eventually explode and do something outrageous. He'll probably start his own social media network in competition to the big two, and it'll be hugely successful. There's no doubt about that. And do you really want that? Because then it become two extremes talking again instead of the moderate middle, which is what we actually need. So, no, I think it's dangerous.
Yeah, I mean,
you definitely know, be out there.
The argument is that what if people who were not on the left controlled social media? What would they do? And do those people who are currently in control of social media assume that they always will be?
Well, they clearly do assume they always will be, but it's a ridiculous notion, because the more restrictive they become, the more gaps they're creating in the market for a new player to step in. The problem is that new player will be the exact
opposite. Amy sent a message saying that his new platform is great, but his newsletters need a little bit of work. So, I mean, he's obviously
I haven't out there. What is his new platform called?
What
Amy?
Is it?
I don't
know. Amy must tell us, because I haven't seen anything about that.
Yeah, I hate to sound very ignorant here, but I honestly don't know what it is. So if you let us know, then we can go check
Gab,
it out.
Because that's no. something else. But no. See, Gab is also extreme on the right side. So you're creating polar opposites rather than something in the middle, which everyone can, and most of us do sit in the middle, not the extremes, which is, I think, is a dangerous situation there.
But and the whole world is moving towards that polarization. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's in Spain or France or the UK, even here in South Africa, you're seeing a lot more of that polarization where people are kind of taking, and sometimes they're taking a stand, not fully understanding what that, you know, what that left or right actually means. And we don't live in a binary world anymore, you know. So
correct.
Well,
while we're on this subject, I mean, I'm going to bring up something which took me by surprise. So I'm currently embroiled in some sort of situation with Media Monitoring Africa. There's a case at the Broadcasting Complaints Commission, which is to be ruled on at some point. But I mean, so it's not me personally, but it's ENCA when we had David Icke on. Do you remember David Icke, the conspiracy theorist? And they Media Monitoring and their legal counsel accused ENCA of allowing this kind of disinformation, is what I think they called it. Merely because David Icke came on and said all of his crackpot things. And I didn't agree with him, by the way, which was put across very clearly by Gilbert Marcus, who was representing our side. But what's interesting here is that they seem to not want to hear anything that is not the gospel, but they also don't want the gospel to be questioned. So that is not a free speech environment. I think we've got to a point where there are people in society who don't understand that free speech isn't just my right to say things, but my right to hear what you say, even when I disagree with you. We launch complaints against broadcasters. I mean, I don't think David Icke has very many sensible things to say, but he's very interesting to listen to. It's like that granny, you know, that granny who starts yakking at like 12:45 and says to you, you know, there was a time when we walked around on all fours. And you, I mean, you're fascinated, even though you know she's talking nonsense. These things need airing.
He's the drunk uncle that you want at the Christmas dinner, but don't really want. He's exactly that.
Right.
He's got fantastic stories.
And it's almost like you're playing into his conspiracy theories by trying to ban him everywhere. What you're doing is you're giving the conspiracy theory oxygen, because you're saying to people, we don't want you to ever interview this David Icke. And then people go, well, why? That's a bit suspicious. Yeah. I mean, let's rather hear him.
No, totally, and that's what it's all about. And I think it's not so much the trying to control the narrative out there, but more it's the death or the assassination of critical thinking, and because critical thinking has died, and it's clearly obvious to see why, and the reasons why it's died is because we're not exposed to points of view that are contrary to ours, and we need to be more exposed to that. We've even seen that in the scientific field now, where the scientists now seek consensus. And consensus is a word that really shouldn't even exist in the scientific field. It used to be about, I have a hypothesis, I put that forward, and I invite challenge to what it is. I invite you to prove me wrong. Now we're seeking peer review and consensus and so on. And that's a dangerous path to travel down. And it's not just in the scientific field, it's everywhere. Even back to politics, it's now we follow the ideology instead of investigating and going deeper into it to challenge that ideology and see, test it and see where its weaknesses are. So I think we need to step back and re-educate our youth, because it starts with them and teach them the basics of critical thinking. Don't take everything for face value.
Where are they going to learn this? I mean, they're not going to learn it at university. Yeah. Our universities are, as Lito said last week, Pumi, they're teaching people what to think, not how to think.
Precisely. Mm. That's a very good statement, and that is exactly what is happening now. And that is the death. They're driving their own preconceived notions and ideas, whether they, especially at a tertiary level, where they are political rather than factual based. And that it's just to mold people into successful voters and successful consumers at the end of the day. And it's a dangerous path we're going down. And it's not just localized yet, but it's a global thing that's happening. So I mean, we talked right at the beginning of the show, that just, do we let it crash?
Yeah.
Or do we try and stop that train?
Pums,
it's too fast and we're too far down the line.
Pumi gets the last word this morning. How do you want to summarize all of this?
No.
You want to say anything to Rob and dear South Africa? Is there stuff that you want to add about free speech?
Of course, I am very ecstatic that there are people like dear South Africa and Rob out there. And I think I hope more and more people kind of wake up. And speaking of the critical thinking, I think it's a good place to end the show. It all starts with us. You know, we also have to be critical thinkers in our everyday world. So when you read what you read in the media, when you see what you see and hear what you hear, it's very important that you take your own moment to kind of review it and think through it and all the various permeations of what it is. We've spoken about it on the show before, that it's not enough to just read one particular newspaper, one particular thing, and one particular point of view.
Yeah.
Even if you don't agree with it, there's always merit in hearing it out, listening to it, and then making your own decision.
Absolutely.
But once you've made that decision, you gotta do something about it. That's why I love what people like Rob do.
Well,
they make decisions and then do something about it. It's not enough to out-tweet each other. You know, like, out-tweet each other and out-debate each other over wine at our dinner parties.
All right. Well, listen, Rob, thank you very much for being part of the Burning Platform today. Pums, we will return next Thursday for even more. And if you have suggestions of people that you'd like to see on the show, if there are people that you would like to hear from, please let us know, gareth@cliffcentral.com. And you can always send us a WhatsApp also on 0797482090. Thanks for your participation today. We will see you next week. Same time, same place. CliffCentral.com.